Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Better Than Bad. As always, I'm your host, Jess. If I do sound a little bit weird, it's because I am recovering from a cold as we were recording this. So if you hear coughing in the background, that's probably me. I do apologise. I'll try and edit it out. But today I am joined by a very special guest. I'm really excited. Hello, Vincent.
You're cruel, Jessica. You give them hope. Hello. Hello, Jessica, and hello, listeners of the delightful podcast, Better Than Bad. Very happy to be here.
I'm glad you're happy to be here. So you've given a little sneak preview as to one of the films that we're going to be discussing today. Do you want to tell everybody who it is that we're discussing today specifically? Because we're discussing a director today. It's not an actor. We're going back to the directors.
Indeed. We are discussing a director who I suspect the majority of film viewers will actually have heard of, because this director is one of the few directors whose name works as a form of star branding in the same way that actors tend to do. You may be familiar with seeing a film with Dwayne Johnson. You may be familiar with seeing a film with Hugh Jackman, but you're probably also familiar with seeing a film by Steven Spielberg.
Yes, we are discussing Steven Spielberg today. I believe everybody will know who Steven Spielberg is. If you don't, for whatever reason, he is an American director, producer, screenwriter. He's probably best known for films such as Jaws, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, and many more. And he's arguably one of the most influential people in cinema history. And he has, according to IMDb, 199 award wins and 249 nominations. And he has won 3 Oscars. So the man ain't doing bad for himself. We're going to be discussing 2 films in particular. As you know, on this podcast, we look at the highest rated film and the lowest rated film on IMDb. His highest rated film on IMDb is Schindler's List, with a whopping 9 stars, which I believe is the highest rated film that has been discussed on the podcast so far. And then his lowest is a film called 1941, which has 5.8 stars, which isn't that low when you really think about it. No, I've seen some 2-star films.
Yeah, I mean, it's over 50%. So
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, put it this way. I'm an academic, and if I was grading something that came out at just over 50%, it's like, oh, hey, that's a pass. You're doing all right.
There's room for improvement.
There's room for improvement. And improve he did as he went along. We're going to start off by talking about 1941. Because it came out first, and we like to do that things chronologically here. Like I said, it's got 5.8 stars on IMDb. It was released in 1979. It's obviously directed by Steven Spielberg. It was written by Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, who are probably best known for writing Back to the Future, which was then obviously also produced by Steven Spielberg. Had you seen this film before doing this podcast, or was this your first time watching it?
This was my first time watching. I'd sort of looked. I've seen most of Spielberg's filmography, but 1941 was one I'd missed. But in the things I had read about Spielberg, there was rarely anything positive said about 1941. So this was my experience of watching this was the experience. I mean, and not only that, I paid money to see this because I had to rent it on Amazon, and I'm glad it didn't cost any more than it did, because I was like looking at it and go like, what? Come on! Oh, it was not a fun experience.
This was my first time watching the film. I'd never seen it before. I hadn't even heard of it before I went onto IMDb and found out that it was his lowest. I'm guessing from that response then that you weren't a particular fan of the film.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that talking here just about more broadly the Dickensian nature of your podcast, for your podcast is to do with the best of times and the worst of times, which I think is especially fitting for the discussion of 1941 and Schindler's List, because interestingly, both films are about one of the worst periods of human history, the Second World War, and the worst tries to make it the best by being funny and fails miserably, and the best emphasises that this was the worst, and in doing so, is the best. A paradox, is it not? Yeah.
Yes. It is quite interesting that both of his films that we're discussing are set in World War II, and have very different approaches to that.
Absolutely. And it's a topic that Spielberg would return to again several times with Empire of the Sun and Saving Private Ryan. So it is clearly it's a great dramatic theatre, if you like. It's a great place to tell dramatic stories. There are a great many films made about World War II, and they are, unsurprisingly, of varying quality. Let's start with 1941, just in case anyone doesn't know, is when the United States entered World War II, 7th of December 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, America joins the war. And this is set shortly after that. So it's actually, here's fun, this is a Christmas film, because it is set December 1941 in the run-up to Christmas. It's set in California. In Los Angeles and just north of there as well, and it's to do with among other the preparations, as it were, for war. We have a Japanese submarine surfaces off the coast of California, and its crew are determined to attack the U.S. And on shore, various different events happen, all largely connected under the banner of preparing for possible invasion.
And it's sort of hysterical Californians being very concerned after the Pearl Harbor attack, thinking that it's about to happen to them, and how chaos ensues.
Yeah, because what we've got is a bunch of unconnected plot strands, and they are brought together quite torturously with these various wacky characters. And at times, I swear I could hear the plot mechanics creaking to bring them together.
Mm. Yeah, and it's just like, it attempts to make this very sort of lighthearted, kind of slapsticky type comedy element, and it is just so painfully unfunny that it's like walking through the worst. It's just the worst experience to watch it. It's like going through like sludge, trying to get to the end of it, because it is. It just feels like such a slog because it isn't funny.
Exactly. And I think painfully unfunny is exactly the phrase I use to describe it, because it. And I think that's, one of the worst things to see some when comedy doesn't work, when comedy dies on its ass, it's like watching a dying animal crawling along, and you're thinking like, please put it out of its misery, or at least put me out of my misery. When I do little reviews of the films I see and post them on social media, and my summary of 1941 is that it is a witless, humorless, crude, clumsy comedy vacuum of cumbersome slapstick, torturously connected character vignettes, racist stereotypes, and utter gittishness that is about 41 minutes too long.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, is that it is a very, a pretty lengthy film. It runs about 2 hours, and it doesn't need to be 2 hours at all. Could have cut out, I agree, 40 minutes of it. So it's sort of, that doesn't help with the fact that you feel like you're really like going through it and like trying to get to the end. The pacing was just all over the place because it is so long. When you compare that to Schindler's List, which is also a very long film at a runtime of about 3 hours and 15 minutes, it doesn't feel as long because everything seems to be there for the most part for a reason. So it's kind of, again, interesting to compare these two and how differently they play out, because this one does feel long.
Yeah, long and slow. And as you say, yeah, it's very, very poorly paced. And note, and you probably know this one, here's a joke for you. Ask me, what's the secret of comedy?
What's the secret of comedy?
Timing. See? And the timing of, just in case folks didn't catch that, the secret of comedy is timing. And the timing of 1941 is, yeah, all over the place, like you said. And is the... I was thinking about this earlier, and I kind of made a list of the various ways this film attempts to be funny. Let me know if I missed any. Okay. The comedic varieties include every character is an idiot. Well, that's hilarious. Mm-hmm. There are slapstick set pieces like pratfalls, and which way is that plane taking off? There are guns pointing through houses, and this is completely obvious to everyone except the moron who is about to fire the gun. There are bumps on the head that lead to all manner of doolally. It's like, oh, I've been hit on the head. And blah, blah, blah. There's very crude humour, like forcing someone to shit out a compass. I shit you not. There are references, like, okay, a reference. The opening scene of this, did you think at what some point, did you think in the opening scene, hang on, am I watching Jaws?
Oh my God, I'm so glad that you mentioned this, because I was watching it. I was like, have I rented the wrong film?
Same.
I was like, I'm so confused. I literally thought I was watching Jaws. I was like, wait, because the music started. It has a little moment with the Jaws music, and she's, this woman's just in the ocean. And I was like, wait, this is the exact opening of Jaws. And I imagined that that was him trying to be funny, but I was like, wait, am I watching the wrong film?
Yeah, it's trying. Oh, look, I'm being funny by being self-referential. And not only does it have the same narrative setup of a woman runs to the water's edge, strips off, dives into the sea, and we've got, I mean, John Williams composed the score for 1941, as he did for Jaws, and indeed Schindler's List, and the vast majority of Spielberg's career. They go together very well. But even there's a shot when the woman heads into the sea and dives in. And the shot angle is identical to that at the opening of Jaws. And the only thing that sort of made me think, okay, this isn't Jaws, because we haven't had any underwater shots. We've not actually had the point of view of the shark. But it's like, oh, I see, you're doing a reference. This is, hey, look, it's Jaws, except it isn't. And you know what else it isn't, Stephen? It isn't funny. There's actually more laughs. There are more laughs in Jaws than there are in 1941. Hell, there are probably more. There are probably more laughs in Schindler's List.
Which says something.
I'll say, yeah. Then, there are racist stereotypes, because the Japanese characters are all terribly concerned about honour, but they are completely incompetent whenever the plot demands it. And just to cap it off, there's a joke. There's some jokes about attempted rape. Now, granted, the rapist gets his comeuppance, but it's worth noting that, as you said, this is written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, who use the same premise in Back to the Future of an attempted rapist who gets his comeuppance, but it's handled so much better there. But, ugh. Yeah, that's...
It's so... I mean, when you put it like that as well, and you list it out, you just realise just how bad it really was. 5.8 stars seems a bit generous, in my opinion, because it was just chaos. That's the one thing that I kept feeling. I was like, this just feels so chaotic. None of these characters are likable. None of this storyline is enjoyable to watch. There's nothing interesting here. I didn't feel, had I not had to discuss it on a podcast, I probably would have switched it off, because there was nothing to keep you there. The performances were unforgettable. Were forgettable. The performances were forgettable. The script was forgettable. There wasn't anything there that really stood out in any way. One of my usual questions on this podcast is, were there any standout moments? And other than just the sheer awfulness of certain parts, I don't feel like there were like standout good moments at all.
Well, I mean, it's worth noting. I mean, it is a stacked cast. You've got, I'm just looking down the cast list. Dan Aykroyd, Ned Beatty, John Belushi, Lorraine Gary, who, if you don't recognize the name, folks, she's Ellen Brody in Jaws. Toshiro Mifune, right? Toshiro Mifune, very well-respected Japanese actor, who was George Lucas's first choice to play Obi-Wan Kenobi. Mifune didn't do... play Obi-Wan Kenobi, we got Alec Guinness. Instead, Mifune did this. Oh, and then there's also Warren Oates, Robert Stack, Treat Williams, Nancy Allen, John Candy, the late great John Candy. Well, there's a lot of late greats here. It's not a, you know, it's a fairly old film.
Yeah, Christopher Lee.
It's as old as me. And yeah, Christopher Lee. Yes, thank you. But I swear they all feel like they've walked, some of them feel like they've walked in from different films. I read some of the trivia that the character of Captain Wild Bill Kelso was originally just going to be a bit part, but then because John Belushi got the role, his part was expanded. But essentially, whenever John Belushi turns up, he's there to do the John Belushi thing. He's like, he can't stand up for more than 5 seconds before he falls over. He drinks, whether it's beer, whiskey, water, coffee, he just spits it out straight away. And somehow he is, and he's able to fly a plane, even with the canopy up and with holding a map and with a strange rubber thing between his legs. That's not a euphemism. Dan Aykroyd doing these sudden monologues that show that he's memorized a manual. Ned Beatty being the aforementioned moron who doesn't know where the gun's shooting. Robert Stack playing this general who is, I'm very keen to see Dumbo. You know, frankly, watching this film, I'd rather have been watching Dumbo too. But, oh, and, oh, okay. I will say this. Oh yeah. And then there's the... there's Tim Matheson as Captain Loomis Burkhead and Nancy Allen as Donna Stratton. He's a horny pilot. Well, not really a pilot. She is a general's aide. He wants to have his way with her, and she gets turned on by planes. So any possible opportunity to get her into a plane so they can get down together, he takes, which includes flying a plane when he doesn't really know how. Because, hey, that's hilarious.
That scene actually made me, like, I was so confused in that scene. Because then they're doing the deed. The plane's flying. And we're like, so, one, you're not flying the plane anymore. You're just having your way with her. And then, two, I was like, they then start getting enemy fire. And they're just there like, oh. And she's just like, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I'm like, you're getting shot at.
I mean, I've heard of being really into it, and I've heard of the Mile High Club, but that's ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah, that scene was something else. But it is true what you say, where it feels like they're all coming in from different films. They're all telling completely different... It's as if none of them knew what the genre was. They all had a different idea, because it just... does not feel like
coherent.
It just doesn't make sense. Yeah, coherent. It doesn't feel coherent at all. It doesn't feel like they're all on the same page. And that's what makes it so, because you go from like the scenes with in the submarine with the Japanese and with Christopher Lee playing a German soldier captain, and then you go into like the dance hall scenes where they're all the people are dancing, and it looks almost like it should be a musical, which interestingly enough, I did read some trivia where apparently halfway through production Spielberg had jokingly said that he should make the film into a musical, and then in hindsight he said that it probably would have helped the film for it to have been a musical.
I read that too. And what I will say is, one thing which is worth noting, I think, from a technical cinematographic perspective, the film is not technically badly directed, because there is fluid camera movement, the editing is smooth enough, and that sequence, the dance hall sequence, the choreography there, yeah, not bad. And it is interesting to note that, yes, I think it might well have been improved by being a musical, but of course it would take Spielberg another 40 years before he would actually do a musical, and do a brilliant one, in my opinion, with West Side Story. I do feel that it's not necessarily badly directed, but it consists of very bad parts. And I guess it's less than the sum of its parts.
it isn't badly directed. The one scene, you know, I know I said that there weren't any particular standout scenes, but the one that I did enjoy at least watching was the sort of music dance hall scene, because of the way that that was shot. I found that quite fun, I guess, to watch. And had the film been a bit more like that the whole way through, maybe it would have been more enjoyable. And it was in that scene that I was like, no, this would have worked as a musical, even with the sort of chaotic, incoherent, different characters, because there's a lot of musicals that exist like that, that have like sort of vignettes of different characters. It probably would have worked better that way. But, you know, like we say, hindsight's 20/20. And he looked back and he went, probably would have helped. But unfortunately, we got what we got.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The sort of like little, you can have the different, in a musical, different character bits, like for that matter, in West Side Story, you can have the different characters, they can have their own little musical numbers, they can do their own little dance bits, and that's fine. We're quite okay with the overall narrative to pause while we have a musical number. That's okay. But again, the trouble with doing this sort of an attempted comedy, I mean, it is a comedy, it's a terrible comedy, but it is a comedy, is that if you're going to have, again, there's no coherence, because you have the two cooks, what are their names? Wally is one of them, isn't it? Yes. Yep. And Wally and Herbie.
The other one.
Yeah.
Herbie's the guy that had the ventriloquist dummy that was on the...
Okay, yes.
I can't remember that. I'm searching through and I literally can't remember the name of the other person. He's not particularly important to the plot anyway.
Wally and Wally's friend, who we were introduced to them doing, actually, something of a dance routine in a diner kitchen. Then they encounter a bunch of GIs and there's a bit of a fight. And then they keep running into this same group of soldiers, and hilarity does not ensue. But it, as I say, that is what I mean by the plot mechanics of like, and here they are, here are the soldier boys, creak, 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 and here are these two bozos in zoot suits, creak, 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 creak. Oh, and look, two of them are going after the same woman. One of them's going to try to rape her, creak, 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 and they're at the house because there's a gun being installed and there's the submarine over there. And at some point, the gun might point at the submarine, and then the wacky pilot, he happens to land at the airfield where the horny guy brings the woman Donna, who he wants to screw in. And the only way to do that is to get her in a plane. And it's a headache. It's a headache of a film. And there were parts in it where I was doing the thing of sort of, I'm watching this, but I'm also covering my eyes, not because it's necessarily going to stop me seeing it, but because if I do that, that feels vaguely amusing.
Yes, literally. It is a slog of a film. It's just, like you said, it is a bit of a headache. There's nothing funny about it. There's nothing endearing about it. The jokes are very dated. Clearly no one even found it funny when it did come out. So it's just a bit of a mess, really. I was sort of watching it, and I guess it's interesting in terms of Spielberg's entire career, because he is such a well-loved director and so highly regarded that sometimes I think people forget that doesn't matter how good you are, everyone's capable of doing something bad. And I think this is definitely his example of that, and makes perfect sense as to why it's at the bottom of his list.
Yeah. Although it is worth noting, I mean, what it led to is, after it didn't do particularly well, and I found its budget was $35 million and its worldwide gross $92 million. So, you know, in terms of for any film, so that means actually, although it made back its budget, for any film release, you've got to effectively triple that to take in distribution and publicity. So I think technically that would qualify as a disappointment, especially after his successes of Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. And so it's worth noting that after that, he did sort of do a change of pace, and he made sure to do things quickly and efficiently in his next film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which worked out quite well, yeah. I think, for everybody.
Yeah, so it was a very quick, like, turnaround to it actually being no one being able to complain anymore and say that he'd, like, lost his touch, because he does 1941 in 1979, and then in 1981 we get Raiders of the Lost Ark, which, as you say, very successful. Everyone knows what it is. One of the, probably up there as being one of the most iconic films made. So he's doing fine. He just made a bad film.
He's had other blips in his career. Spielberg himself has said that every so often he goes back to look at Hook and he can't find anything in it he likes. Many will deride and curse or even deny the existence of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And I've come across some very negative responses to Ready Player One, which personally I really liked. Mm. But hey, nobody's perfect.
No, and yeah, this is the thing with his career as a director. It's kind of a bit of a mixed bag. There's so many different types of films, so many different genres that come into play that it's sort of, there's bound to be things that don't resonate with certain people. It's interesting that he says he doesn't like Hook, because I know a lot of people around my age where that's one of their sort of favourite childhood films. And something that they kind of grew up on. So it's just sort of, I guess it's like interesting to see what resonates with people and what doesn't, and even what resonates with him as a director.
Absolutely. Plus, I mean, yeah, he's made other comments about some of his work he's looked back on, like in case of Close Encounters, saying that looking at it now when he's a parent, he would have done that differently. He would do that differently because that does involve a man abandoning his entire family. So, you know, fair play to reflect on that and have another, a different perspective.
That comes with age and change and becoming a different person as you get older and priorities shifting. It's not a strange occurrence for someone to look back at their work and go, well, actually, I wouldn't have done it like that, or I'm not as happy with that. But regardless of any of those blips that he's had within his career, I think it's fair to say that most of his stuff has been top notch. So yeah, as directors go,
he's got a pretty consistent,
he's one of the iconic ones.
Totally. I was talking on another podcast recently about if one was to do like a Mount Rushmore of film directors, it would probably consist of Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick, and Steven Spielberg. Mm. It's unfortunate that that's a bunch of white men, but that's unfortunately the Hollywood industry for you. May it hopefully it'll. I mean, I think there are changes happening. They're incremental and slow, but I look forward to when we can have we can talk about as many great female directors as we can male.
Were there any other things that you wanted to mention about 1941 before we move on to Schindler's List?
Well, Spielberg himself isn't proud of it. And I've got to wonder, and I'd be surprised really if anyone who was involved in it, I mean, obviously, you know, various members of the cast are dead now. But maybe many of them considered a bit of their blot on their CV. At least we can safely say everybody involved in this movie did better work elsewhere.
Yes. And speaking of better work elsewhere, we can move on to Mr. Steven Spielberg's highest rated film on IMDb, which is Schindler's List. As I said before, it has 9 stars. It was released in 1993, obviously directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Steven Zaillian, and based on the book by Thomas Keneally. I assume you'd seen this film before, but I might be wrong.
No, I had. I've got a. I was thinking about what my history with this film is, because So this came out in in the UK, its release probably wasn't until sort of early 94. And I probably got a re-release when it was up for awards. And I potentially could have gone to see it in the cinema because it carries in the UK a 15 certificate, and I would have been 15 just about in time for it. But I didn't. I didn't actually see it until probably around 2005 or 6. I bought a DVD of the film before seeing it. Back when I was buying, you know, DVDs quite regularly, and I thought, well, I should probably own Schindler's List. I know it's a big deal. So I remember watching it on disc at home and being, you know, blown away. I watched it again a few years later with some friends. They knew, so, you know, they felt, well, we should probably see it too. They were both impressed as well. And then this was... And then I watched it this weekend on the smallest screen I've seen it on, just on my laptop in preparation for today. But I had quite a special experience back in 2019 when it was screened at my local art cinema for Holocaust Remembrance Day. So I actually got to see it in a cinema. With a recorded video intro from Spielberg. And it's often a way, I think, that if you can see a film on TV multiple times, but then seeing it in the cinema is always something special and something that, and that additional experience of watching it in a cinema made me appreciate it all the more. It's a film that I've seen 4 times. I won't pretend it's one I go to for a fun viewing because it's not a fun viewing, even if it weren't for the subject matter and the way the subject matter is handled. It's bloody long. It's, as you said, 3 hours and 15 minutes. But I think that's entirely appropriate. It's a film that demands your attention. It's the kind of film, if you're going to watch this, put your phone aside, put your phone on airplane mode, so that you're not going to get distracted, and give it your full attention. Because what's interesting is, I think it is definitely a film that is not, it's a film that demands your full engagement, not because the plot is particularly complicated, but because it's asking you to engage with some important and weighty material. And for that, you know, your attention is required.
If I had the opportunity to see this in the cinema, I would take up that opportunity straight away, because I do think there are certain films that I watch and I think that needs to be seen on a big screen, and this is one of them. I watched it for the first time today. I hate to admit that, because it is obviously such a highly regarded film and it has been on my watch list for such a long time, and I would go to watch it and I'd be like 3 hours 15 minutes and then I wouldn't watch it, and it's frankly just me being lazy, but I have obviously now watched it and I'm so glad I have. I was blown away. It's outstanding filmmaking on every level. I have never cried so much at a film in my life. My God. By the time the film ended, I was like, I can't speak for at least half an hour. I was like, I hope none of my housemates see me, because I was just like red-faced from crying. It was just so well done. And I'm so glad that I finally got round to watching it. And if there is anyone listening who's like, I've never watched it because of the length, just put that to one side. Like you said, put your phone on airplane mode and watch this film.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because it is an experience that is a powerful experience and I think any powerful experience that is a positive one. It's not pleasant. But at the same time, it is worth saying that it is not in any way some kind, it is not a dirge, it is not misery porn at all. It is. I remember. I've been listening to a lot of your previous episodes, and I remember in your episode to do with Dev Patel, you and your guest talked about Lion, and there were one of you commented on that feeling like somewhat misery porn-esque. I wouldn't just say that's a way of describing Schindler's List because of the way it is put together. Now, this raises, I think, some important points, which is going to prompt me to talk at great length about some stuff, if I may.
Yes, feel free.
Great. But actually, just firstly, I'd like to ask, you said you cried at the film a lot. Does that mean that there were multiple scenes that prompted you to cry?
Yeah, it was okay. Like every other scene. That's what it felt like.
Fair enough. For me, there tends to only be one scene that gets me every time, and I'll come on to that. But what I want to talk about is how much of the admiration for this film is to do with the subject matter and how much is to do with the cinematic craft. And I've just realized we haven't done any kind of synopsis, have we? We probably should, just in case.
Yes, it's set in German-occupied Poland during World War II, and it is about the industrialist Oskar Schindler, who begins the story as sort of an opportunist businessman looking for slightly cheap labour. And then as time goes on, he becomes more and more concerned by his Jewish workforce and about their well-being, and ends up essentially saving the lives of over 1,000 Jewish people during the Nazi occupation, and stops them from being sent to Auschwitz so that they can come and work for him. It is based on a true story.
So, as you say, it is based on a true story, and I'll come back to that. But it is, okay, subject matter wise, this is a film about the Holocaust. It is a film concerned with the murder of 6 million Jews by the Nazis. And in the midst of that atrocity, one of the darkest chapters of human history, we've got this story of hope and of humanity. In what Oskar Schindler did in saving, as you say, 1,100 Jews from the gas chambers. Now, whenever you have a drama that deals with the Holocaust, I think it always provokes a certain amount. It always provokes discussion. It always provokes strong feelings. There are other films that are concerned with the Holocaust, like The Pianist, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, Life is Beautiful. And all of these deal with the subject of the Holocaust in different ways and are subject to particular levels of scrutiny. There are also important documentaries like Night and Fog and Shoah that have looked at the subject. And it's arguable that subject matter like the Holocaust is so profoundly dark that it's incredibly difficult to talk about. And I think it's also difficult for those of us who are obviously very distanced from these events by time. Our only form of access is some type of, some kind of mediated form, whether it's in the form of a fictionalized film, whether it's documentary, whether it's the, whether it's a book, whether it's first-hand accounts of the actual victims. Now, I've had discussions with friends who say that they feel uncomfortable assigning a rating to Holocaust films, to sort of describe a Holocaust film in terms of its entertainment value. And then I've had other conversations who complain about the, and I'm using this term in massive scare quotes, historical inaccuracy, because it's worth noting that the events as depicted in the film Schindler's List are not quite the same as those in Thomas Keneally's novel, Schindler's Ark, or indeed the, you know, the historical records that this relates to. A big deviation from the historical records, for instance, is that in the film we see quite a jovial relationship between Oskar Schindler and the camp commandant, Eamon Goeth, played by Ralph Fiennes. And apparently in reality they didn't have that relationship. Schindler just hated Goeth. So I'll come back to the historical records in a minute. But to the first point about how we feel assigning a rating to a Holocaust film like that, which has given Schindler's List the nine star rating on the IMDb, for instance, I think it's important to remember that films are artifacts. They are products that have been assembled, and they are not their subject matter. So however significant or trivial the subject is, I think it only makes sense to judge the film as an artifact within its context of as what it is. And I think that notions of what an artifact should be, or indeed what our responses should be, tend to create more problems than they cause. So I think it's important to understand that when we do an assessment of this film, we are assessing it, we are reacting to it as a film, as a narrative, as a drama, as an entertainment product. That is what it is.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you.
And then the second point about the, again, in scare quotes, historical inaccuracy. Well, of course, this is not what actually happened. It's a film. Films and all stories differ from historical records. And I think it's important to remember historical records themselves are not reality. There is inevitably and inherently mediation and rewriting. Now, I think this is where the issue of it being a Holocaust film becomes an issue, perhaps, because it is such a severe issue, it's got to be handled in a certain way. But I think it's unfortunate. Well, okay, I don't agree with the idea that because it's a Holocaust drama, it's got to be treated exactly the way the records record it as happening. So, according to records, Schindler and Goethe, for instance, did not have the cheerful relationship they have in the film. Schindler hated and had contempt for Goethe. Now, my question is, would presenting that relationship necessarily work dramatically? Because I would suggest that it wouldn't work when the drama requires them to work together and interact. We see them having a kind of camaraderie, and the film draws a parallel between them. There are points where there are edits between the two of them, both of them preparing for the morning and shaving, so doing similar activities. But then there are also cuts between dissimilar activities, like there's at Schindler's birthday party, he kisses a whole lot of women. And then at one point we cut from Schindler kissing a woman to Goethe beating a woman. So we're seeing parallels, but also contrasts. And I think what the film is suggesting here is that Schindler could be like Goethe, and his turn away is a development as Schindler's character. Because as you pointed out, when we first see him in the film, he's very much a profiteer. He's opportunistic. And his arc, Schindler's arc of the film, is about developing into a humanitarian. And it's also worth noting, I think, that Goethe isn't only presented as being cruel and greedy and a dedicated Nazi, but he's also spiteful and childish. So the hatred and contempt that Schindler might be, according to historical records, had for him, I think that hatred and contempt is instead invited from the audience. So that when Schindler turns against Goethe, the audience could well be thinking, what took you so long? This guy is repulsive. You stand on the deviation from historical record perspective.
I think it's sort of like it's something that's got to be seen within the context of the piece. At the end of the day, you can't have absolutely everything in there. I read somewhere as well that Ben Kingsley's character is sort of a more inflated version of what that person actually did in real life, and that he was less involved than what is seen on screen. It is always difficult when you discuss these things, as particularly in regards to something as heavy as the Holocaust, because when you say things like, oh, it's got to work for the pacing and it's got to work for the dramatic purposes and the film, it makes it feel like you're trying to just change things for entertainment value. But at the end of the day, it is also a film. And it has to work that way in order to be able to show the story properly. Because like you say, something this film does really well is that it engages its audience. Because it would be very easy, I think, for something that is as heavy as this, for an audience to kind of shy away from it. And it engages its audience by, for example, the relationship between Schindler and Goethe. So I think that when done appropriately and when you deviate from things, obviously it has to be done appropriately. But I feel like this film doesn't move away from the historical records enough for it to be too much of a concern, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about part of the piece and now, to be fair, obviously a big part of this piece, an important aspect of Schindler's List, it is about putting the Holocaust on screen and giving audiences who, when it was released in 93, were 50 years distant from the Holocaust. Now, here we are, 30 years after the film's release almost. It'll be in 20 years from now, it'll be, 100 years since the middle of the Second World War. And something that film has a great ability to do is to make events that might be distant in time become immediate and become, bring history to life, as it were. And that doesn't mean necessarily slavishly recreating the historical events, because you're never going to be able to do that. And I think any attempt to do that would be doomed to failure. The great film critic Roger Ebert said that at its best, film is a machine for generating empathy. And I think that is what Schindler's List, and indeed Spielberg's oeuvre as a whole, is exceptionally good at, is generating empathy. Now, another complaint I come across about Schindler's List is the scene right towards the end when the war has ended and Schindler, the Jews that he has put on a list that he saved from the camps, he leaves them because he's got to go on the run into hiding because he's now a war criminal. And he does this speech of saying, "I didn't do enough, one more life." And as I understand it, that's pure invention. That's that is a narrative, a Hollywood, a Spielberg, a dramatic conceit. Well, newsflash, the film is an invention. It is based on historical events, but it is not those events. It is a narrative drama. And that one more life speech is, I think, really useful because for the audience, it provides a release. Throughout the film, we have seen Oscar being stoic, being contained. But in this moment, we can see him break. We see he becomes vulnerable. He bursts into tears and everyone's around and hugging him. And we can empathize with that. And I think this is because of Spielberg's particular skill with sentimentality. Is something that gets thrown around as an accusation, as if it's a bad thing. Spielberg has said in interviews, "Yes, my films are sentimental. Of course they are. That's what I do." And he demonstrates his great skill at using sentiment in cinema to evoke empathy. He does it in E.T. He does it in Close Encounters. He does it in The Color Purple. He does it in Empire of the Sun. And he does it in AI. Does it in Saving Private Ryan. Now, you said earlier that you had cried every other scene through the film. For me, cliche, the point that makes me cry in the film is that speech. "I didn't do enough, one more life." And I suspect I'm not alone in this. I mean, I imagine you cried at that scene.
Absolutely. I'm an emotional mess, so there's always that.
Now, I think for some people, okay, maybe that scene doesn't work for you, and that's perfectly fine. But I think that dismissing the scene or criticizing it because it differs from historical records, it just seems too easy. And because this appears to be judging drama by the standards of, scare quotes, reality or history. But drama and history, they serve different cultural purposes. And what a piece of drama, even with a fairly close relationship to historical records, is this is about talking to the audience who are engaged with that piece and saying, here is something human for you to engage in. And that is, and it works as like an emotional lightning rod, because there was there's the famous line said about, this was said actually about what's also been described as Stalin's Holocaust, when something like 30 million Soviet citizens starved under the Stalin regime. But what was said about that is, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. And while we can say, you know, yeah, 6 million Jews were murdered by the Holocaust, it is something that is, well, we can say that's terrible. How could we allow that to happen? How did this happen? It is at the same time maybe too much to grasp on an emotional level. Whereas put something on screen and you give us this emotional lightning rod to feel for it emotionally, then I think that is in keeping with the spirit of recording the event. And that's what I think one of the things, and the way that is handled so carefully by Spielberg. At no point do I think this film becomes crass or indulgent. It's very well balanced.
Yeah, so I'd never heard the criticism of that final sort of scene. And for me, it was a case of like reminding people of the human loss, because it's like you said, it's so easy to just distance yourself from it, whether that be because of, you know, time and where we're at now, and or just looking at it as a statistic. It is like when you see that scene and you see him break down, it's that kind of feeling where a lot of people like to say that if they were in a position like that, what would they have done to help? And how this man did so much to help, and yet it maybe wasn't enough. And so it's a reminder of like the human loss. And yes, that may be sentimental, but surely it should be. It's an emotionally charged time in history to think of. And so having that moment, to me, felt like it tied up the film in a way that tied up the character, made you understand him more, made you see him more human. I didn't watch that scene and think, why is this here?
It's weird, you know, thinking about it and talking about the scene again, I'm welling up all over again.
Yeah, it's really like, it's a lot.
It is,
but it makes sense to the plot. It makes sense to what the subject matter is. To have this idea that, and a reminder to people who are watching, that this, if anything, you know, it is a very Hollywood dramatic ending. That's undeniable. But when you watch the whole film, as emotionally charged as it is, that point serves as the reminder of, this isn't really this story, despite the fact that it's called Schindler's List. It's not about Schindler. It's about the people he saved. That's the story. So that's what that scene served as a reminder for, the human beings that suffered in that time period.
And as Ben Kingsley's character Stern says, that this list is an absolute good, and also what's put on what the Jews engrave on the ring they give to Oscar. He who saves one life saves the world. Of course, what we've talked about a lot here is to do with the subject matter and the way that's the narrative is handled. But I think it's also important to say, you can have the most powerful, the most the most profound subject matter, but it's got to be handled and presented in a way that is going to work for an audience. And we've talked a little about the filmmaking, and I've got to say, every time I've watched this film, I have appreciated it even more on a filmmaking level. I mean, there's a lot made about this. Is, I believe, still the highest grossing black and white film that's ever been released. And it is, you know, notable. This is a film that is mostly, aside from a couple of moments, in black and white. But what's interesting is that cinematography, although it is often depicting the most horrendous events, it's also beautiful. The you know, turning the, you know, the faces, as well as the buildings, and the expanses of space. These are kind of it's a hauntingly beautiful film to watch. There are, you know, a variety of different types of camera shot. There are crane shots, such as when we're looking over the over the labor camp that Girth builds. There are handheld cameras, you know, various moments where you've got the liquidation of the ghetto, which Warsaw ghetto, and you've got cameras sort of running through the streets as if we were alongside either the Jews running or the Nazis chasing. There are some extraordinarily composed shots, like there's a woman who comes to visit Schindler at his office, at his factory, a couple of times. And twice we see Schindler standing at the top of a flight of stairs, making great use, it must be said, of Liam Neeson's significant height. He's a very tall fella. Seeing him at the top of this flight of stairs, it's like something out of an Eisenstein film. This very strong silhouette at the top of these stairs, and the stairs themselves forming this kind of jagged cut across the frame. Then there are moments where there are these long takes where the camera just rests on a face, often Schindler's face, or not so much resting, I guess. It's slowly panning around him. Mm. It's allowing us to sort of, it's expressing so much thought. It's a great example, I think, of that watchword of cinema, or watch phrase, really, show, don't tell. Schindler knows what's going on, and we know that he knows from the way the camera is following him, not necessarily doing very much. And when it's time to look at the utter horror of what's taking place, I mean, the camera doesn't flinch away, like when Girth is on his balcony and he is shooting at the prisoners below with his rifle, just because he's bored. You know, we see that happens. Like, oh, God, he just did that. Oh, Christ, that was horrible. Or the point when a bunch of the prisoners are being separated out and they're made to strip off and they're running around naked. And then we have the absolutely horrendous sequence when a group of the women are taken to Auschwitz and they're put into what we think is a gas chamber. And again, we're waiting for them to be gassed. We think they're all going to die. Spoiler, it's okay. But it doesn't flinch away from showing us. And then, you know, when we see people get shot, they just sort of drop to the ground, like with no fanfare, or that's not sentimental. That's just being upfront and brutal. And again, in the black and white cinematography, you're seeing the blood that runs out of their heads. It looks black. And then there's also things like the graphic matches, like I mentioned earlier, when cutting between Schindler and Girth to draw these parallels between them. And I think it's important to note that, yes, this film has a very important topic, but the responses we have to the film, we only have them because we have been so superbly manipulated. Now, manipulated is a bit of a loaded term, and some would say, and I have heard responses saying, well, I was enjoying the film, I was with it up to a point, but then I realized I was being manipulated and that took me out of it, which is fair enough. But it's worth noting that anyone who says, I don't like being manipulated, should not watch films, because that is what film does. Film manipulates, manipulates your emotions. And Spielberg is a particular master at doing that. And it's because he is so good at doing that, at manipulating our emotions, that he was able to take the subject matter of Schindler's List and turn it into the magnificent work of cinema that it is.
No, I completely agree. And like, he doesn't shy away from the brutality, which at first can feel quite shocking. You're sort of watching it and you're like, oh, I don't know whether I want to see this. But at the end of the day, that was a reality for people during that time. It was brutal. So to not shy away from that shows it as authentically as possible for a film. I found the film to be very atmospheric. I felt so engrossed in it, and I think that is down to just the careful filmmaking and like the consideration into making it. The scenes, like you say, in the liquidation of the ghetto, felt you were stressed watching it. It was a stressful experience to see it, and that's in part due to those handheld camera moments and that feeling of being in the midst of the chaos. And I love those scenes where they do their editing with the cuts between Schindler and Goethe, because like you say, it shows a comparison. It shows a difference between the two. I noticed it initially with the scene of them getting ready, but it sort of particularly caught my attention when it was his birthday party. And then you cut between Schindler being very jubilant and happy, and then you've got Goethe, like you say, beating up a woman. And it's these stark contrasts, these moments of quiet, which I think a lot of films shy away from sometimes, is having those moments of just quiet and watching the character, watching the person on screen. And this doesn't shy away from any of that. It completely encapsulates what it's trying to say, alongside being such a well-made piece of cinema.
Yep, absolutely. It's a piece of work that makes full use of the cinematic medium, I'd say, and is able to put its use and utilize the medium to produce so much feeling. And I think it's, you know, you mentioned, you know, this is, you know, it's showing something that is horrendous, because that's what people experienced at that time. It's also worth noting, again, I'll go back to what I said about the spirit of the piece with relation to what you said, because it is possible to do a Holocaust film which is not as stark or as brutal as this. I'm thinking here of Roberto Benigni's film Life is Beautiful. Have you seen that?
I have not, unfortunately.
Okay, well, I highly recommend it. But what's interesting about that is it's set predominantly in a concentration camp, but predominantly from the perspective of a child who is, to a large extent, being shielded from what's happening. So it is possible to indicate what's happening without doing it explicitly. And Life is Beautiful does a really nice job of that, a really effective job. It's a heartbreaking film, but a beautiful film, but it does so in a way that's very different to Schindler's List. Schindler's List is going for, we are going for the big emotional gut punches here, people. Strap yourselves in.
I was looking at people's reviews on Letterboxd after I'd watched the film, and there was someone who put a thing up saying that they felt like they were annoyed by the way that the film was handled, because they felt like it leaned on this idea of people having hope in a hopeless time. And I found that to be a weird thing to be frustrated by, because I don't doubt that these people did have some hope. Obviously, we don't know exactly how they feel. I remember when I read The Diary of Anne Frank, and there's a quote in that that really like stuck with me, where she writes that in spite of everything, she puts, "I still believe that people are really good at heart." And beyond that being a very profound thing to say for such a young person to write, I just felt like that shows the time period and how, despite everything, these people found something to keep going. So when I saw that review, I was a bit confused, because I felt like also from a cinematic perspective, if something is completely devoid of any hope, I don't think anyone would want to sit and watch it. I thought it was a strange one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is a weird response to say, well, I think this film should just be about utter hopelessness. You want to watch a film of utter hopelessness. Do you though? Do you really?
You did your little quote at the beginning, you know, where he's, you know, you are giving them hope and that is cruel. There's so many poignant moments in there that are about people being hopeful and believing in somebody else and believing that they will help them. That's what for me makes the scene where the women's train ends up in Auschwitz even more gut-wrenching, is because there's a small moment where I almost was like, did he just not actually list the women? And you have a doubtful moment and you think, oh gosh, like he's just left them. And then you find out that there's supposedly been a mistake. That's what makes that scene even more gut-wrenching and even more nerve-wracking, because these people put their trust in somebody and then there's a moment where it's completely taken away.
Yeah, agreed. But it's also worth noting, of course, yes, I mean, on the one hand, has he abandoned them? But then there's also the fact of their lives literally could have been decided by a clerical error. And here's something I will say about Schindler's List. It is probably the film with the most terrifying desks in cinema history. There are multiple scenes. There's the opening scene where we have a train pulling into a station and all Jews are required to register. And we have the desk, we have the forms. And then later on at the labor camp, we see the desks being put out. Before that, there are the desks laid out at sort of the entrance into the ghetto. And every time we're seeing these desks and the forms and the paperwork being used. And it's worth noting, of course, that if we do at this point lean back into the historical records, so much of the Holocaust was organized in this clerical fashion. And we are, to an extent, seeing that being put on here. And there's the old line of those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And the practice of being able to dehumanize people by reducing them to numbers is something that we have seen repeatedly in terms of, think about the contemporary debates over immigration. And it's a matter of, well, there's all these people who are coming, there's all these, there's too many refugees, too many immigrants coming into the UK. I know, let's leave the EU. And yeah, well, I won't go on a political rant, because if I do, we'll be here all night. But I think it's, and of course, drawing a parallel to the crisis in the war in Ukraine, where President Putin was talking about having to push out the Nazis in Ukraine. And you sort of look and it's like, no, I don't think there are Nazis in the Ukrainian government. But the point being that it's this, the practice of othering, the practice of dehumanization, the practices of clericalizing, if that's a word, people away. It's, I don't want to be too grim here, but I think to some extent we haven't learned from history and we see it being repeated. So more people should watch Schindler's List and get there and maybe learn something from it.
Yeah, because it's like you do feel like you're a part of it. That's that atmosphere thing coming back through again. It's this feeling of being involved. And so when you see those scenes with the desks in the ghetto, I think are really poignant, because you see just how quickly someone can be taken away. And the scene where the man goes to hand his work permit over and says what he does, and then they're like, well, we don't need you, you're not essential. And then they Ben Kingsley's character runs through and gives him a replacement work permit to say that he is an essential worker. And it's just this idea of people so easily being just put into these boxes based off of what their career, their ability to work, and rather than just being people. And you see them being carted up and to be presumably to the camps, and it's done in a way where it's it's so poignantly done without it sort of bashing you over the head with the point. It doesn't need to do that. It doesn't need to spoon feed it to you. It is that show don't tell idea with those scenes where you know what's happening and then you see it from a different perspective and you're like, okay, I'm stressed out watching this. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I do at the same time. And it's just so perfectly crafted. I don't really have any other way of putting it.
Yeah, I think you've summarized it very well. It is perfectly crafted. It's not easy to say in many cases that this is a perfect film, but having seen it on multiple occasions now, I don't have any problems with it. Even, you know, even at a film of this length, one might expect it to drag even, but I don't think it does. It's actually, it's paced in a lively fashion. It is atmospheric. It is haunting. At times it's actually, there are funny moments in there. So it's superbly shot, it's superbly edited, it's superbly scored. John Williams's score, he's always amazing. But my God, I love, sometimes if I just want something that is going to be simultaneously soothing and haunting and melancholy, I will put on the Schindler's List theme. It's superbly performed. Liam Neeson, Ralph Fiennes, Ben Kingsley, the rest of the cast, everyone in it is superb. Another thing that's interesting about watching it repeatedly is you start noticing some of the other characters who are actually, you know, appear throughout. It's like, oh yeah, that guy, oh her, and they all have their own sort of important little stories as well. And perhaps most fundamentally, it's entirely accessible, even though it is dealing with material that is to some extent, you know, distant in time, distant in you know, comparable experience for the majority of viewers, and so profoundly grim, but makes it accessible, makes it engaging, makes it empathetic, so we can look at this and understand this is horrendous. But the way in which it's being delivered is beautiful. And therefore, so it's almost doing that great, the thing that was described about certain, I think, 19th century artists. It's doing the sublime. It's presenting something that is beautiful and terrible all at once. And is that not the best thing that cinema or any art form can do?
Yeah, it is perfectly made, in my opinion.
No argument here.
Yes. Were there any other moments or things that you wanted to, like?
I guess just a few sort of like standout moments. There's the famous moment of the liquidation of the ghetto where we see the girl in the red coat. And I had forgotten, though, that we see her. So we see her walking through the ghetto. She hides under a bed eventually, and then the color drains from her coat. And then we do see her again later, dead. Mm-hmm. And I'd forgotten that. It's like, oh fuck, she ended up dead as well. Well, of course she did. So that was striking. I remember the first time I saw it, a point that really hit me hard, and it does every viewing, when there's a roundup being done in the camp. And we follow this small boy looking for a place to hide. And eventually he hides in the latrine. He literally drops into a big tub of shit. And I just remember the first time I started going like, ah, Jesus! And yeah, every time that really makes me wince. How about you? Any particular standout moments?
Yeah, the red coat moment is obviously a standout. I read somewhere that apparently Spielberg had put that in because he'd had a conversation with Audrey Hepburn and how she had seen something similar, and how it had struck with her, this seeing this young person in such a colourful outfit and then mixed amongst everybody else. And he had thought that would be a good image to use within the film. One of the lines that really struck me was when they were talking, Schindler was talking about setting up this business. He was talking to his wife about setting up this business and how it was being quite lucrative for him. And she said, oh, yes, something along the lines of, it's down to luck. And he says, no, war. And I just thought that that was such a poignant line in terms of just history, that there are people who profit off of war. And there are just so many moments of just shock, and you see these people going through life, and when the when they're building the camp, and the Jewish woman says that everything has to be torn down because of the infrastructure is wrong, and Goethe just says, shoot her, I'm not having an argument with her, to then take her advice after he's killed her. Just these little moments dropped into the film that just shock you, disgust you, and just show you how, in terms of war in general, but particularly with that, with World War II, there's this complete disregard for human life. And I think this dropped in a way where, like I said, you don't feel like someone's screaming it at you. They're not going, look at this. You're seeing it and you're observing it yourself. And that, again, is one of the reasons why I think this film is so well made, because it's not, I think sometimes films can kind of, I don't know if you've had this experience, but you'll be watching a film, you feel like you're being like hit over the head with a point, like they're trying to hammer it in. Whereas this doesn't need to.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes hammering someone over the head can work.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, I would hope it's a shorter film. For something like this, it makes sense that it does it in ways that are both, there are hammer strokes, but there's also, but sometimes it's also very delicate. Yeah, I think you could pick multiple moments from this film work as demonstrations of how to use cinema as generating empathy, of how to use the components of cinema to present something that is, as I said, that is sublime, that is beautiful and terrible, all at once. And, you know, just many images of it would just make, you know, beautiful images you could hang on your wall.
I think the epilogue is also a really poignant moment where the actors accompany the real life survivors to the real life Schindler's grave. Mm-hmm. It's like, whoa. Like that was a point where I was watching it and I was like, oh my God. Like, just, and again, a reminder that it's based on real life. It's not just been a film. Like, these are the people. And again, I think it's just a smart and clever choice from Spielberg to have that. Are there any other sort of Spielberg films that are particular favourites of yours? Is this your favourite, or is there another one?
Yes, no, yes. There are plenty of other Spielberg films that I love. This isn't my favourite, but I do have a favourite. My favourite Spielberg film is not one of his best regarded ones, I think. It is one that, when it was released, it was critically well received, and much like Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, Jaws, The Color Purple, and Lincoln, it did get a lot of awards attention. It was up for Best Picture. Didn't win anything, though. And I think it is Spielberg's grimmest and boldest film, a film that explores the psychological and the philosophical and the political ramifications of revenge. And at the time of its release in 2005, resonated very strongly with a lot of political and social discourse that was going on at the time. Because my favorite Spielberg film is Munich. Is that one you're familiar with?
I haven't actually seen Munich. I know that there was a sort of a few films around, because people call it his like 9/11 trilogy, don't they? Where it was sort of after.
Yeah, 9/11. War of the Worlds and Munich. And no, I wasn't aware of the third one.
Is it the? It might even be the terminal, you know. The one.
Oh, that would make, yeah, that does make sense. Yes, yeah. The terminal, because of the airport and the being trapped. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yes, they all so, have their strong points.
I haven't seen Munich. I really like, well, I'm a sucker for Jurassic Park just because I love, that's just like a childhood favourite. What's not to love, right? Yeah. And I was sort of going through his filmography, actually, and I realised that he's one of those ones where everyone knows who he is. And then I was looking at the list and I was like, I haven't seen as many films of his as I probably should have. I will add Munich to the top of the list if it's your favourite.
What are the others on his list that you feel particular that you think are particularly important that you should see?
Right, because I haven't seen Empire of the Sun.
Okay.
I haven't actually seen Lincoln.
Okay.
And I haven't seen West Side Story yet. That is on my list. I've obviously seen the original West Side Story, but
I'll make a this may be a controversial thing, but I prefer Spielberg's West Side Story to Robert Wise's 1960 version. Yeah. I think Spielberg is more cinematic.
Yeah, no, I really want to watch it. I just, you know, life, I haven't got around to it.
Yeah. I've seen most of his, but I've never seen The Sugarland Express.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not seen Always.
Mm.
But yeah, I've seen everything else he's done, and I'm looking forward to I've seen everything else he's directed, and I'm very much looking forward to The Fablemans, which is his next film, which, as I understand it, is somewhat autobiographical. But yeah, I have actually seen every film of his since Hook.
Wow. I need to up my game with the Spielberg films. Well, I have to ask this question because it's the whole point of the podcast, even though it seems very obvious what the answer will be. Which film did you prefer?
Oh, I much preferred 1941 because it showed me how much worse my life could be by watching that forever. No, I jest. Schindler's List, far and away, the better film.
And same for me.
It's a hard watch, but if you gave me the choice, right, you're going to watch 1941 again, 2 hours of that, or Schindler's List, 3.25 hours of that. It's like, yeah, I'll go for Schindler's List. Thank you.
Absolutely. I like to always ask if there's anyone else that you think I should discuss on this podcast.
Yes, so many. I mean, directors, I think it's great that I know you've already done an episode on Bong Joon-ho. I expect you may have some other directors lined up, but I would certainly love you to do an episode on James Cameron, on Catherine Bigelow, Jane Campion, Christopher Nolan, and maybe you'd even consider having me back on if you were to do an episode on Michael Mann, because I wrote a book about Michael Mann, so I do very much like talking about him.
Well, I know who to go to.
Yeah. And in terms of actors, I think if you haven't already got these lined up, it'd be great to hear an episode on Meryl Streep, on Jessica Chastain, on Kate Blanchett, as well as Leonardo DiCaprio, Christian Bale, Russell Crowe, and one of the stars of my personal favourite film of all time. I would love to hear an episode on Al Pacino.
All amazing options, some of which have not been mentioned before, so I will make sure to add them to my list.
In case anybody was wondering after I mentioned it, my favourite film of all time is Heat.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your, what I can imagine is busy schedule to talk to me about these films.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. It's been a blast.
I hope you've had as much fun as possible talking about some pretty depressing situations. So do you want to tell the people where they can find you on the socials?
Yep. Well, you can find me on Twitter, for now anyway, and Instagram and Letterboxd at Dr. Gaine. That's DrGaine. From there, I'll post links to the reviews I write, the publications I've made, as well as the other features I produce, including links to my own podcast, Invasion of the Poddy People, where I appear, which is a monthly podcast where I talk with my co-hosts, Russell and James, about genre movies, about we do reviews, we do features, we do news, and we every month we pick a recommendation of an old, a new, and a something, not a film. So check it out on your podcast feed, people. Invasion of the Poddy People.
Like I said, thank you so much for joining me. That was honestly one of the most interesting discussions I've had about film. I'm really grateful for you taking the time to talk to me. Thank you so much
for giving me the opportunity.
Yes. And I will just say to the listeners, thank you to everyone for listening. And I hope to see you next time on Better Than Bad. Thank you so much.
In the next episode of Better Than Bad, I will be joined by the lovely Kat, and we will be discussing Margot Robbie. We'll be talking about her highest rated film, The Wolf of Wall Street, and her lowest rated film, an Australian horror film called I See You. Interesting. Find out what we think next time on Better Than Bad.